Chapter 23, for those of you who come here on Sunday nights, you're not here on Sunday mornings, Calvary Newsletter. Calvary Chapel Newsletter is kind of a newsletter that we do around here, and the second issue just came out. You can pick up a copy at the tape counter or the sign-up counter or the bookstore. It just kind of tells you stuff about what's happening, introduces you to things, and it's just a way of processing, getting information into your hands another way as it gets harder sometimes to keep everyone up to date on stuff. Also, be aware that flyers related to the Israel trip are out on the sign-up table also. So, Isaiah chapter 23. In Isaiah chapter 23, God declares to Judah and to all of the world, and especially to Tyre, the coming fall of the city of Tyre to Assyria. The city of Tyre was with the city of Sidon, two very major trading centers for the entire Mediterranean. And they became very, very prosperous. They were main cities of an area of the world known as Phoenicia, which was on the Mediterranean. It is, to a large degree, what we would call today modern-day Lebanon, which is immediately to the north of Israel. But they were fabulously wealthy because of their training. The Phoenicians, those of you who are familiar with history, world-famous historically for their navy. I mean, no one could beat the Phoenicians. Even Alexander the Great, with all of his greatness later on with the Grecian Empire, was horribly defeated each time he tried to take on the Phoenician navy. He wasn't much of a navy guy. He was a big-time, you know, army guy. And so they were very well known for their trading and commercialism. The burden against Tyre, and it's the mainland city of Tyre, not the island of Tyre. That's another story that we'll get into in the book of Ezekiel. He said, "Wail to you, ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste," speaking of Tyre, "so that there is no house, no harbor. From the land of Cyprus it is revealed to them." The area of Tarshish was probably what is modern-day Spain today. And so you have the navies that went out from the city of Tyre to do their trading along the Mediterranean. Their ships went out as far as Tarshish there in Spain. They're making their way, doing their rounds, their commercial rounds, and they get to the island of Cyprus, and all of a sudden they receive word that their hometown of Tyre has been destroyed by the Assyrians. And so that's what God is speaking through Isaiah long before it happened, and sure enough it did happen, as the Assyrians ultimately did take the mainland city of Tyre. "Be still, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon," and that was again a city 30 miles north of Tyre, a kind of twin cities of the Phoenicians. And so word now has spread. It would be kind of like an economic meltdown for the entire region of that world. It would be worse than a stock market crash for us. For Tyre to be utterly destroyed in its commercial capacities involved many, many nations. And so we're talking about, you know, it would be like the Asian stock markets crashing, the European stock market crashing, the United States stock markets crashing, the South American stock markets, well, they're always crashing, but I mean crashing, and, you know, so you kind of, but I mean, like, sometimes when just one will crash, the others can kind of buoy them up a little bit for a while, as we're seeing right now. Here we see the entire region begin to sink, and so it would have been terrible news all around that region. And so the news came to Sidon, whom those who crossed the sea have filled. And so Sidon filled with the wealth of the merchants, and on great waters the grain of Sihor, the harvest of the river, speaking of the Nile, is her revenue, and she is the marketplace for the nations. And so widespread impact of this collapse of Tyre in that day. Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea has spoken, the strength of the sea, saying, I do not labor nor bring forth children, neither do I rear young men nor bring up virgins. And so God is talking about the fact that Tyre, along with Sidon, they were cities that became fabulously wealthy. Men were making money hand over fist, but there was no labor involved. They were doing it by virtue of trading. Now the problem is that there's nothing wrong with making money. You know, if the Lord wants you to make a lot of money, make sure you spend it where He wants you to spend it. But there's nothing wrong with being rich as a Christian. Nothing wrong with being poor as a Christian either. But here they were making tremendous amounts of money, but they were making it on the backs of other people. They weren't doing anything. They're bringing in fabulous sums of money, but at the expense of other people. In the book of Revelation, God condemns a Babylon that He refers to as a commercial Babylon. In, I think it's chapter 18 of Revelation. Chapter 17, He denounces and He speaks of the coming destruction upon a religious Babylon of the last days. But He talks about a commercial Babylon also. And the commercial Babylon that He speaks of His judgment coming upon is a commercial system that takes the eyes of people off of God and then takes advantage, undue advantage, of other men. Now you have an economic system that's been built upon something that God must ultimately judge. When the economy becomes something that competes with God for the attention of His people, or for the attention of people in general, now you have something that's competing now with God, and God is never defeated by anything that He's forced to compete with. Economic systems that take advantage of other people, ultimately He has to bring a judgment on. And so here they were making tremendous amounts of money, but they were taking advantage of people in doing that. Modern day example of something that's been in the news so much is the Nike Corporation. Here is money being made like nobody believed that money could be made. Fine. Terrific. Tennis shoes for $40. Tennis shoes for $180. Fine. Do what you want. But don't hire people for $1.10 a day in developing nations of Asia and then make that kind of a profit and not expect that to displease God. So you have this economic system where they were making so much money, but on the backs of the people. It's very sad. Sometimes you go into Cost Plus or you go into Pier 1 or some of the different places and you'll see like a carved elephant or something like that that's come, you know, from India. And I've been to India, and I'm going back to India soon, and you can buy them for $2. You can buy them for less than that, and then you go in there, and they're $35 and $40. That's a lot for the middleman to take, and for that money to be made somewhere, and then here are people living in poverty while you do that. And that's a system that isn't right, and that's kind of what had developed here as it relates to Tyre. And God spoke to Tyre and Sidon, and He says, I'm going to bring shame upon you for this. And ultimately He did. And in the last days, He will bring His judgment upon commercial Babylon. He will do it, and that He'll do that during the great tribulation. So He says in verse 5, when the report comes to Egypt of Tyre's destruction, they also will be in agony at the report of Tyre. Now, Cairo and Egypt also became wealthy off of that whole trade thing that was going on there, because they could bring their grains and their rice and all and enter in to the trade that was happening there in the Mediterranean. And they used the expertise and the marketing of Tyre in order to do that. Cross over to Tarshish, again speaking of Spain. Wail, you inhabitants of the coastland, is this your joyous city whose antiquity is from ancient days, whose feet carried her far off to sojourn. Now, the city of Tyre was one of the oldest cities in the world. It was a city that came into existence about 2700 B.C. And so there's a tendency, even among God's people, to look at something that's been around that long and say, wow, it's been around for 2,000 years, and I mean, nothing is shaking it yet. I mean, surely this is a sure place to put your money and a sure place to invest it in. And yet, if what they're about is something that's contrary to what God is about, ultimately judgment is going to come upon it. There is no safe place to put my money in this world, because God is going to bring his judgment on this whole world, because the world, by and large, lives in rebellion against God. And that's why God says, invest in my kingdom, invest in my work, because we're going to leave it all behind anyway. And so that's what he encourages us to do. And so here they are. Everyone figures, well, boy, you know, this has been around this long. That's been around this long. That's a sure place to put my money. Ooh, make sure you know what they're involved in. God says he's going to judge that which is making money in an unrighteous fashion. He said in verse 8, who has taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes, whose traders are the honorable of the earth? The Lord of hosts has purposed it to bring dishonor, to bring to dishonor the pride of all glory, and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. And so here were all of these rich men, these rich merchants, these rich princes there in Tyre. Everyone looked at Tyre, looked like the Rock of Gibraltar. I mean, nothing could ever affect that city. And yet God said judgment was going to come upon it. And God was going to bring his judgment upon it. And he was going to bring his judgment upon that commercial system in order to jar it back into reality. To jar it back into reality, to remind them that they're not as big and as smart as they think that they are, and that there is a God in heaven that they're going to answer to. And so he warns them, and the destruction came through the Assyrians. It's interesting that when God describes that judgment of commercial Babylon in Revelation chapter 18, let me read a couple of verses to you about this because of one particular section of it. He said, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon, and incense, fragrant oil, and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour, and wheat, cattle, and sheep, horses, and chariots. These were all of the things that commercial Babylon was trading in. And then God said also, the bodies and the souls of men. He looked at the religious of that commercial system, and he said, it's not just a commercial system anymore. Again, now you're competing with me for the minds and the souls of human beings. And so when the commercial systems become bigger, that becomes the thing that gets worshipped. Oh boy, be careful. God is going to bring his judgment upon it. And it's really a snap for him to do that, isn't it? It's not like he has to go out, pump some iron and all to get worked up to order to do it. Now, it's been interesting the last few years. Economics is a fascinating thing for me to follow. And so the last few years, how everyone was talking about the Asian markets, weren't they? Get your money into those Asian markets, because that's where it's going. The United States and our market, it's passe, we're moving from it. That Pacific Rim is where it's happening. So get your money into the Asian markets. And now look what has happened to the Asian markets. Now look what has happened to Japan, this economic powerhouse. Their recession continues. Tremendous difficulty with their banks, tremendous corruption among their leaders and among their banks. Of course, the Korean thing, the whole bottom fell out of that whole thing, and it's being bailed out by the International community now financially. This was Asian stock markets. Investing there was a can't miss for the last 2 years. And when the market collapsed in South Korea, I was at a health club here locally, and I was on a Stairmaster or something. And as I was on there, the guy that was right next to me, we were watching on the screen the minute-by-minute report of the stock market in the United States zooming down by the hundreds of points. And this guy that was standing right next to me, I looked at him and I said, what's happening here? And he, what's the cause of the thing here? And he said, well, gee, nobody knows right now. But he said, I was heavily invested in the Asian markets. And I haven't seen him at the gym since. So I don't know if he can afford the fee now every month, to even come. I mean, is that quick how things can change? And that's why Jesus said, he said, take heed and beware of covetousness. For a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Verse 10, overflow through your land like the river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength. He stretched out his hand over the sea. He shook the kingdoms. The Lord has given a commandment against Canaan to destroy its strongholds. And he said, you will rejoice no more, O you oppressed virgin, daughter of Sidon. Arise, cross over to Cyprus. There you will have, also you will have no rest. So again, we see the oppression that was going on. It is interesting how the churches fill in times of war and in times of recession. When people are faced with difficulties that are all of a sudden they recognize as being bigger than them and all. So it's interesting, maybe God in our day, he'll just come in and he just shakes those institutions. And then everyone goes, oh no, what's bigger than those institutions? And God just goes, just kind of clears his throat. And once again, most often, or very often, he has to do it even among his people. You see people get prospered, God blesses them and all, and I can just look at them. Bye-bye. See you at the next recession. Don't forget where we are. And that's about what it takes. They come back, they've lost everything, and now they come back in. It is a dangerous thing. Now, I was listening to the news here this last week, and the average citizen of the United States of America, do you know what the average citizen's credit card debt is in the United States of America per person? $7,000. $7,000. We're not talking about homes. We're not talking about cars. We're not talking about home consolidation loans. We're talking about credit card debt. That is an indication, a strong indication of what our nation as a whole is tapped into in terms of what it worships. Because you watch where the money goes, and then you have an idea of what is worshipped within a nation. I hope that if you're in that kind of debt as a Christian, that you are on your way out of that kind of debt. In the book of Proverbs, it says, the borrower is the servant to the lender. I lose my freedom when I'm in that kind of debt. God can't just say to me, Damien, I want you to move over here and I want you to do this. Well, I'll use this guy over here and you go ahead and take. It's no good. It's just no good. So we have to be careful of these things and be careful that we're not worshiping the same gods that this world worships. He said in verse 13, behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this people which was not, Assyria founded it for wild beasts of the desert, and they set up its towers, they raised up its palaces, and brought it to ruin. So the Chaldeans were the Babylonians, and the Assyrians initially did defeat the Babylonians, but ultimately the Babylonians were going to rise in power, the Assyrians fall in power, and they would be defeated by the Babylonians. Wail, you ships of Tarshish of Spain, for your strength is laid waste. And so, the tremendous warning. God tells us, as his people, not to trust in the wealth of this world, but to trust in him. God is in control of the wealth of the entire world, and he can bring it to nothing overnight. And he tells us as his children, he said, having food and clothing, with these things, let's be content. Food, clothing, a relationship with him, and involved in his call upon my life. That's where fulfillment is found. Not in bigger and better and all of this kind of commercial system. It's found in a relationship with him. And the great thing about a relationship with him is that that relationship will never, ever fail. It'll never fail. These systems of the world, they will fail. And the highest use of our money is to bless God, and it's to bless people. Jesus said, do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now it came to pass in that day, verse 15, that Tyre will be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of a harlot. And so for 70 years, she was forgotten because the Assyrians maintained control of Tyre. But as Assyria's power began to wane, at the same time, Tyre was able at the end of 70 years to break off Assyria's yoke and again begin to establish itself commercially. And he speaks to her and says, at the end of 70 years, Tyre will happen to Tyre as in the song of a harlot. Take a harp and go about the city, you forgotten harlot. Make sweet melody, sing many songs that you may be remembered. And so, like a prostitute singing in order to reattract her customers that have been gone for a while, so Tyre would do materially. It's interesting that God looks at he can look at the commercial systems, especially when God's people begin to worship any kind of an idol, the worship of anything other than God. God looks at that and he considers that harlotry. That's unfaithfulness to the relationship that we've been called to in him. So his image is very, very accurate. And so to see that commercial system of the world as a harlot isn't a bad image for us to be aware of as we serve the Lord in these last days. And it shall be, verse 17, at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she will return to her pay and commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world on the face of the earth. Her gain and her pay will be set apart for the Lord. It will not be treasured nor laid up, for her gain will be for those who dwell before the Lord to eat sufficiently and for fine clothing. Ultimately, you know where all the money's going to end up? In the Lord's hands. It's all going his way. And so at the time of the millennium, the entire wealth of the world will be under his control, and he will use it to feed and to clothe his people. What a beautiful thing. Chapter 24. God's been talking about the judgment that's going to come on Babylon and Jerusalem and Egypt and all in Tyre and all of these places. And now in chapter 24, he begins to talk about the judgment that's going to come upon the entire earth. Notice in verse 1, behold, the Lord makes the earth. Now he's talking about the whole thing empty and makes it waste, distorts its surface, and scatters abroad its inhabitants. And so Isaiah is now prophesying about a judgment that is going to come upon the entire earth. And he's talking about the great tribulation when God pours his wrath out upon the entire earth. And the earth is completely inhabited by a group of people that are living in rebellion to him, having rejected his son. And so chapter 24 kind of anticipates the fuller handling of this whole subject that God was going to reveal through the Apostle John in the Revelation. And so now he talks about this judgment on the whole earth. It shall be as with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with his master. As with the maid, so with her mistress. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with the borrower. In other words, no one's going to be able to escape this judgment if they're here on the earth. And whether you're rich or poor, nobody escapes this judgment. It's going to come upon all levels of society. As with the creditor, so with the debtor, the land will be entirely emptied and utterly plundered. No one is going to escape, for the Lord has spoken this word. There's no protection from the judgment that God is going to pour out on this earth during the great tribulation. No protection from it at all. In Revelation chapter 6, when God speaks about beginning to break the seals of his judgment upon the earth, John wrote and he said, "And I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. And then the sky receded as a scroll when it's rolled up." You ever do one of those things with a, you know, you draw the kind of a, whatever that kind of a curtain is called, you pull it down and you kind of misjudge it, and it goes up there. He said, "That's what's going to happen to the sky." Now, I don't want to see that. I don't want to be here, and I don't have to be here because I love the Lord and have accepted his salvation. But that's what the sky is going to do. Every mountain and island was moved out of its place. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave, every freeman hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us, hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" And so that judgment is going to be a judgment upon the entirety of the earth, and no one will be able to stand before it. Verse 4, "The earth mourns and fades away. The earth languishes and fades, the world languishes and fades away. The haughty people of the earth languish. The earth is also defiled under its inhabitants." We're doing a wonderful job on planet Earth, aren't we, by the way? "Because," and then here is the cause of the judgment that's to come, "because they have transgressed," and transgress means to willfully disobey. In the Old Testament, when it talks about sin, you could sin if you were trying to do right and you fell short of it. To transgress was to know what was right, know what God said, and then willfully go against it. And he said, "Because they have transgressed the laws," what laws? God's laws, "and changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant." And so that's why the judgment was going to come. They changed the ordinance. It's interesting to see today what man has done with God's ordinances. Look at what man has done with God's ordinance of marriage. Is by and large, it's disregarded. Disregarded. Now marriage is being redefined as it relates to two men being married or two women being married. And I love what Paul, you know, God said through Paul in Romans. He says, I mean, doesn't even nature itself teach you that that's wrong? It doesn't fit together that way. It's not the way, and it doesn't matter what kind of a tendency I might have in my flesh. I don't personally have homosexual tendencies, but I have other tendencies that I don't want to have people say, "That's right just because you have them." It's not right just because I have them. My flesh is my flesh. And when God says it's wrong, it's wrong. Doesn't matter what it is or who I am. And so we see the ordinances change. We see the ordinance of the family, what God considers a family to be, what he wants a family to be. And now in our great United States, the state of New Jersey has now passed a law to allow the adoption of children into homosexual couples. And you look at it and it's not like people don't know what they're doing. But here is a violation of God's ordinance. And God's ordinance of marriage was one man, one woman for life. And so often, you know, you see people who say, "Well, you know, Jesus, he never, you know, spoke against homosexuality." Wait a second. When he spoke about marriage, he went back to the beginning in Genesis. And in the beginning, the model for marriage in Genesis, the model, was one man, one woman for life. That's God's ordinances. But we see God's ordinances just being cast by the wayside. And men and women think they are so smart. And they think they're so much smarter than God. Now, I've been there. I understand that. Well, not too good, I don't. Because even when I wasn't walking with the Lord, I knew he was the guy. I mean, it wasn't like I thought I was smarter than him. And so even when I wasn't willing to walk with him or obey him, I acknowledged that what he said was true. But today, man in all of his wisdom, undoing God's laws, undoing God's ordinances. Now, what you know, you see right and wrong completely turned around. And what he says is wrong, everyone says is right. What he says is right is portrayed as being wrong. And God says, as it relates to the whole world, that's going to be a sign of the last days. And it's a sign of a world that is due judgment. I marvel. I'm a graduate of Napa High School, 1973. And I cannot believe how quickly things have moved in my adult life. And moved from just common sense, right and wrong. You get, all you got to do is just find someone on a desert someplace, bring them in from another planet, and just get their assessment as it relates to this stupid world that we live in. I can't believe what the judges come down. I mean, it's just, it's nuts. It's absolutely crazy what's happening here. But the boldness of the rebellion, the boldness with which people defy God, and they defy his word, and they elevate their opinions. I'll tell you, it makes it very easy to pray. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth even as it is in heaven. And it makes it very easy to understand and to realize that by the time he pours this kind of judgment out upon the earth, that that is completely and totally the kind of person that he will be dealing with. And so just that arrogance and that fighting against God, it's a sign that judgment is coming, that pride and that rebellion. Pride is to simply see myself above. To see myself above another person, that's pride. The height of pride is to see myself above God, or to see myself smarter than God. I've never met anyone smarter than God, and I know that I won't. And he says, therefore, verse 6, the curse has devoured the earth, and those who dwell in it are desolate. And therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. As you read Revelation chapters 6 through 19, the number of people that survive the Great Tribulation is proportionately very, very small. The new wine fails. So all of the parties and all of the this and that, you know, the vine languishes, all of the merry-hearted sigh, the mirth of the tambourine ceases, the noise of the jubilant ends, the joy of the harp ceases, and they shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. And so the world will be giving itself to wine, and basically giving itself to pleasure, and this careless pleasure that they are addicted to. And we are a nation that is addicted to pleasure, addicted to pleasure. I forget what they had. I mean, it was like 10 years ago in the United States of America, the amount of money that was spent on pleasure per year in the United States of America alone was over $300 billion a year. I don't know what it's become in the last 10 years in the economic recovery. But we live in a nation that is addicted to pleasure. What's the next movie that's coming out? What's the next CD that's coming out? What's the next series of things on TV? What's the next drug? What's the next coffee? What's the next this? What's the... And it's just moving from the one pleasure to the next pleasure to the next pleasure. And so that's what they were involved in. And God says that it's all going to come to an end. It's interesting that as he talks about their drunkenness there, and given themselves to the wine and all, but it's all going to come to an end. Verse 10, the city of confusion is broken down. And he's talking about any typical city in the Great Tribulation. Every house is shut up so that none may go in. There is crying for wine in the streets. I mean, that's the depth of rebellion. God's judgment poured out on the earth, and everyone's still, you know, looking for where the party's at. All joy is dark and the mirth of the land is gone. In the city, desolation is left and the gate is stricken with destruction. When it shall be thus in the midst of the land among the people, it shall be like the shaking of an olive tree. In other words, when the olive tree is harvested and there's just a few olives left, there'll be very few who will survive this period, like the gleaning of grapes when the vintage is gone. They lifted up their voice, they sang, and so here is apparently a remnant during that great tribulation that will survive it, and they see God's judgment being poured out upon the earth, and they rejoice in it. They shall lift up their voice, they shall sing for the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the sea, and therefore glorify the Lord in the dawning light. The name of the Lord God of Israel in the coastlands of the sea, from the ends of the earth, we have heard songs, glory to the righteous. And so here is a group of the righteous on the earth during that great tribulation, and they see God pour out his judgment, and they rejoice in his judgment coming upon the earth. Now, we don't know really who this remnant is. Could be the 144,000. Could be the Jews that were flee from Jerusalem during that abomination that causes desolation into the area of Petra. Or it could be a reference to many will come to know the Lord during the great tribulation. After the rapture of the church, they'll realize they've made a mistake. The judgment starts to be poured forth, and they'll turn to the Lord. So perhaps it's referring to them. But here is this that is crying out, praying for and praising the Lord for his judgment. For us, again, our prayer daily. And it helps keep me sane. It helps keeps me sane. I think every part of that prayer is key to perspective in our life as a Christian. But the Lord's Prayer, as it's called. But as we pray on that daily basis, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's just something I need to know that that's coming. That's coming. That's going to happen. And to know that I have prayed today to be a part of that becoming a reality in this earth. Notice he says, in continuing in verse 16, but I said, Isaiah said, I am ruined. Woe to me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Indeed, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. As Isaiah looks at all of the wickedness around him, as he looks at all of the judgment that's coming on wickedness, as he looks at, you know, God trying to reach people and get them to turn to him, and he sees instead of people repenting, he sees them giving themselves to even greater wickedness. And so Isaiah, you know, cries out that, you know, against this, the wickedness that's abounding around him, even in the face of the strongest warnings of the Lord. And so, you know, it can be hard. It can be hard to take. It can be hard to watch it happen. And that's why we have to remember on a daily basis that God wins. God wins. He's going to win. It'll be rather effortless for him too. All of this that is going on is simply making manifest individual hearts of man. But God is not threatened by it at all. And he wins, and his victory will ultimately be revealed to be as full as it actually is. Verse 17, he said, fear and the pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth. Well, you know, fear's bad all by itself, but you throw a pit and a snare in there, and now I'm in real trouble. And so, you know, that's a lot to have against you. I mean, in other words, he's saying you're not going to be able to escape what God is bringing. It's going to be like fear and then falling into a pit, getting out of a pit, and then getting trapped. There's no escape. Fear and pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth. And it shall be that he who flees from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit, and he who comes up out of the midst of the pit shall be caught in the snare, for the windows from on high are open. In other words, there's no escape for the unrepentant sinner, and the foundations of the earth are shaken. We're not talking about just a couple of tectonic plates or whatever, you know, the San Andreas Fault or whatever. The foundations of the very earth are going to be shaken during the great tribulation. The earth, Isaiah said, is violently broken. the earth. Now, we're just not talking about Southern California. We're talking about the entire earth all at once. The earth is split open. The earth is shaken exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunk. I mean, it's just going to go back and forth, back and forth. And it shall totter like a hut. In other words, it's going to collapse. And its transgression shall be heavy upon it. And it will fall and not rise again. And it will fall because of its willful rebellion against God. I don't want to be on the earth when all of that is poured out. And I won't be on the earth. I'm going to be at a marriage supper of the Lamb. I'm going to be tasting everything that's there. I have my new body. And so I'll be enjoying it. But this is what's going to come upon the earth. And so this is the end of rebellion. There is no future in rebellion against God. There's no future in it, because this is the way that it's going to end. Again, we live in a society where you have the proverbial frog, right? Throw that frog in, you got a pot of water on the stove, and put that frog in when the water's cool, and bring that up to a boil slowly. That frog will boil to death right in the water. Throw it right in when the water is boiling and hot, and that frog will jump right out. And so we live here, so much in the United States of America, and there's this idea that if enough people don't like what God has to say, that somehow their rebellion is overlooked by God. And it's not overlooked by God. Rebellion against Him is very, very serious. And it puts me in a place where I'm going to experience His judgment, because I'm aligning with something He's promised to judge. I'm aligning with sin. And God has said He is going to judge sin. Don't align with sin. Align with Him. Rebellion against God is a very serious thing on the earth. And if it's not taken seriously by those on the earth, it's taken very seriously by God. Verse 21, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will punish on high the host of exalted ones, and the earth, the kings of the earth, they will be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and they will be shut up in the prison. After many days, they will be punished." And so God is talking about the rulers of the earth during that great tribulation. At the end of the great tribulation, He will gather them together for judgment. He talks about the kings. In all of this, there's surely a reference to the Antichrist, to the beast, as he's otherwise known, to the false prophet, to Satan himself. All of these will be cast into the lake of fire, and then after many days they'll be punished, speaking of the white throne judgment, and then into the eternal lake of fire. God's judgment is going to come upon the whole demonic realm that is behind the rebellion against God that occurs here on the earth. And then the moon will be disgraced and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign. So after the great tribulation and after all of the the millennium and all of everything, after the white throne judgment, then the moon is going to be disgraced and the sun is going to be ashamed. Why? Because Jerusalem, New Jerusalem, the light for New Jerusalem is going to come from Jesus Himself. And so there won't be need for the light that comes from the moon and from the sun. For the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion in Jerusalem and before His elders gloriously. And so we're told in Revelation chapter 21, verse 23, that the city, New Jerusalem, had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it, and the Lamb, speaking of Jesus, is its light. And so John gives greater insight to all of what Isaiah was talking about. Jesus is going to reign there in Mount Zion. Chapter 25. In chapter 24, it talks about the great tribulation. Chapter 25 refers now to the kingdom age. And chapter 25 is a song where those that are in the kingdom age praise God for His judgment that He brings upon man's rebellion. The fact that God does not allow man's rebellion to go on indefinitely, that He brings it to an end. And there's going to be joy on the earth when that happens during the millennial reign. And so, verse 1, O Lord, you are my God, and I will exalt you, and I will praise your name, for you have done wonderful things. Your counsels of old are faithfulness and truth, and you have made a city a ruin. And so he's likening the world to a city. So here's just praise for God's wisdom, praise for God's faithfulness, praise for God's truth, praise for his works, because in that kingdom age, nothing will compete with those things. I mean, can you imagine an entire world living in harmony with God and in complete submission to his ways and to his will? It's going to be outrageous. And that's what's coming. That's what's coming. And when it happens, there's going to be that realization of how great of a toll it took on us to go against the stream here, you know. And so once we're in the middle of that, all it's going to do is just solicit praise from out of our heart. Oh, God, thank you that you brought that nightmare to an end in order to establish this. And that's a choir that I want to be a part of after God has completed his harvest, though. He said, for you have made a city a ruin, a fortified city a ruin, a place of foreigners to be a city no more, and it will never be rebuilt. Therefore, the strong people will glorify you. The city of the terrible nations will fear you, for you have been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy, a dry place as heat in the shadow of a cloud. The song of the terrible ones will be diminished. And so here is the song, and it appears that you have God's people that have been persecuted through all of the ages, and the persecution that they have experienced at the hands of wicked man for thousands and thousands of years, it's being likened to kind of standing in the sun, you know, in the middle of the desert, and their persecution just burning you to death. And now as God establishes his kingdom, it's like a cloud comes in between all of that persecution and God's people. Now there's rest. Now there's safety. Now there's protection. And one day it's coming. In verse 6, and in this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wines on the lees. And so here is this great feast that God is going to have established for his people. No hunger in the kingdom age, no hunger on into eternity. Here he's talking about, you know, I mean, the best of foods. And the, you know, today we can go down to the supermarket and buy a big chunk of cow muscle and barbecue it and eat it. And I mean, for them to have a chunk of meat, wow, I mean, that's the best of the best. And then, you know, the good wines. And God is saying that he's going to provide for us very well. And he will destroy on this mountain the surface of the covering cast over the people and the veil that is spread over all the nations. He will swallow up death forever. And that's the veil that covers all of the nations, is death. And God is going to swallow death up forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. The rebuke of his people he will take away from the earth. No more persecution of his people on the earth, for the Lord has spoken. Now, you know, you sit here and sometimes, I mean, you can fall asleep on something like this. Not if you're persecuted. Not if you're persecuted. Not if you're being persecuted for righteousness' sake. I mean, this thing grips your heart that one day it's going to end. One day God is going to win. It's worth it. It's worth living for him. It's worth doing right. I'm on the right side. And so these words would have been just like a balm on the hearts of the righteous that were being so persecuted through all of the ages. And it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God. We have waited for him. And so now there's that rejoicing. We waited for him, and he will save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. So the day coming even for the child of God who is the most persecuted as a person can be. The day is coming when there will be that rejoicing over the choice that they have made to follow the Lord, and the how worthwhile it was to wait for Him and to wait for His kingdom, and to putting down of the enemies of God's people. For on this mountain the hand of the Lord will rest, and Moab will be trampled down under him as straw is trampled down for the refuse heap, and he will spread out his hands in their midst as he who swims spreads out his hands to swim, and he will bring down their pride together with the trickery of their hands. The fortress of the high fort of your walls he will bring down, lay low, and bring to the ground down to the dust. And so there wouldn't be any protection from the judgment that he was going to bring. And he talks about Moab as being typical of the nations that persecute his people. And so he speaks of the judgment that was to come upon the nation. Let's head into 26. In that day, again speaking of the kingdom age, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. This is a song that's going to be sung in that millennial reign. And they're going to say concerning Jerusalem, we have a strong city, and God will appoint salvation for walls and bulwarks. In other words, in the kingdom age, what we'll be singing there in that kingdom age is there's going to be praise to God for the safety of Jerusalem. There won't be any anything that we have to put on our cars or on our homes or anything like that. It's going to be a safety in the world. Imagine that. Open the gates that the righteous nation, which keeps the truth, may enter in. You will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you because he trusts in you. And so the kingdom age is going to be an age of complete trust. It's going to be a time of perfect peace because everyone is going to be trusting in the Lord. And so as we trust in the Lord is faithful never to disappoint us with that trust. And so we're kept in perfect peace because our mind is stayed on God because we trust in Him. Trust in the Lord forever, for in Yah or Yahweh, the Lord is everlasting strength. For He brings down those who dwell on high, the lofty city He lays low, all the great cities during the great tribulation. He'll wipe them out. He lays it low to the ground. He brings it down to the dust. The foot shall tread it down, the feet of the poor and the steps of the needy. And so the kingdom age is going to be a time when meekness and humility is going to be rewarded rather than rebellion against God and arrogance and oppression against other people. Meekness and humility is what God is going to reward. Imagine that. I mean, a whole world just filled with meek and humble people. It's going to be really something. It'll be nice to drive there, to be sure. Verse 7. The way of the just is uprightness. O most upright, you weigh the path of the just. Yes, in the way. And so you see the way, the path, the way. Yes, in the way of your judgments, O Lord, we have waited for you. The desire of our soul is for your name and for the remembrance of you. And so here they're talking about the kingdom age is going to be a time where people are going to live according to God's paths, according to God's ways. It's going to be something, again, to see the world, I mean, a perfectly righteous world. And that's the way that it's going to be. And with my soul I have desired you in the night. Yes, with my spirit within me I will seek you early. For when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. That's a good thing to learn. It'd be nice if we could get, maybe an elective class or something currently in the schools on righteousness. But I'd be asking too much. I'd probably have to wait till the millennium. But that's all that's going to be taught in the millennium, which will do wonders for my blood pressure. Let grace be shown to the wicked, yet he will not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness, he will deal unjustly, and he will not behold the majesty of the Lord. And so the wicked are going to be ashamed of their wickedness during the kingdom age, and their life will be rather short in their rebellion against God. Again, there's no future in wickedness. Lord, when your hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they will see and be ashamed for their envy of people. Yes, the fire of your enemies shall devour them. And so, you know, a guy goes to do something, and, you know, I've always thought about, I mean, in other words, justice will be very swift. Now, one of the things I did, I think I mentioned this months and months ago, and it didn't go over very well. And so it's a bit risky for me, especially given the fact I just have 5 more minutes. But when I was a kid, I used to think about, I would think about crime and these kinds of things. And I was really into superheroes. I had all of the Fantastic Four comics and the Silver Surfer. And I had all of this stuff. And my dad would get them free. And so we'd stock up on these things. And so I often thought, wouldn't it be something if on just a given, just one night in the United States of America, every criminal, when they would go out to commit their crime, whatever they were going to commit against someone else, that would be committed against them. So if they went out to murder someone, they ended up murdered that night. Or maybe they just shot themselves or whatever. Somehow you went to shoot someone else and then boom, you got shot and you died. Whatever your intention was. And listen, allow me a tangent here for a moment. That would be like, that would be the swiftest judgment you could possibly have. I mean, recompensed immediately. And he's not talking about that kind of thing exactly here. But he is saying that justice will be very swift. Evil, wickedness won't be tolerated. Not for a moment. Won't have any space given to it at all. Lord, you will establish peace for us. Speaking of the righteous, speaking of Israel. For you have done all our works in us. O Lord our God, other masters beside you have had dominion over us, but you only we make mention of your name. By you only we make mention of your name. So here is Isaiah, and he's crying out to God, and he's crying out for the others that are alive in his time, that are love God, they're righteous in their walk and all. And he said, God, you know, we've walked with you, we've served you in the middle of rebellious nations, and because of it, we've been, others have had dominion over us, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Grecians, the Romans, all through the history of the nation of Israel. And so he cries out and he says, and all of this has come upon Israel because of their sin. And it's come upon us even though we've been righteous because we're among these people. But he said, God, in the midst of all of these things, we haven't failed to mention your name. They are dead. They are not, will not live. They are deceased. They will not rise. Speaking of these oppressors and these other kingdoms. Therefore, you have punished and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. You have increased the nation, O Lord. You have increased the nation. You are glorified. You have expanded all the borders of the land. And then he says, Lord, in trouble they have visited you. They poured out a prayer when your chastening was upon them. And so he says concerning the average person among God's people there, or the wicked, when trouble came upon them, all of a sudden now they wanted to pray to God. And of course, Isaiah and the others, it didn't take that for them to pray to God. And so he says, as a woman with child is in pain and carries out in her and cries out in her pangs, when she draws near the time of her delivery, so have we been in your sight, O Lord. Speaking of the prophets, we have been with child. We have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not accomplished any deliverance in the earth, nor have the inhabitants of the world fallen. And so here is Isaiah, and he likens himself to those that have been faithful to God. He says, we've been through great difficulty. We've had foreign masters. We've been through so much pain. It's like the pain of bringing a child into the world. But there was no joy. At least when a woman has a baby, there's the joy of having that baby at the end of it. At the end of our whole thing, it was just like a wind. It was emptiness. It was vanity. In other words, nobody's turning to you despite our ministries to you, God. And so, you know, he's just crying out about the difficulty of being righteous in a wicked world. And then he says in verse 19, your dead, speaking of the righteous dead, shall live. Together with my body they shall arise. Awake and sing, you who dwell in dust, for your dew is like the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. And so Isaiah declares concerning himself and concerning all of God's righteous children that have died in the midst of those kinds of circumstances, and he says, listen, the story isn't just the life that you went through in this world. One day you're going to rise again. And there's going to be a righteous reward for the ministry that you have performed. And so you're going to rise again unto a reward. And so Isaiah is living under the weight of eternity in his ministry to the Lord. And it's so important that when we serve the Lord here on this earth, that there is that realization that I may not be rewarded in the way that I think on this earth, but one day I will be in eternity. And so he speaks of the fact that they will raise from the dead. And of course they did when Jesus went down into the grave, into Abraham's bosom there during the 3 days before his resurrection, after his crucifixion. It says in Ephesians chapter 4 that when he arose, he led the captives from their captivity. And the men of renown walked around the city of Jerusalem for some period of time, we don't know, and as they came up out of Abraham's bosom and then into heaven with the Lord Jesus. And then God, having listened to Isaiah and listened to Isaiah speaking to him, now he speaks to Isaiah and to his people, and he says, come, my people, into your chambers and shut your doors behind you. And so this appears to be a reference to Israel during that great tribulation, following the abomination that causes desolation, where they flee into Jordan, into the rock city of Petra, for them to be protected. Hide yourself, he says, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation, that is his indignation that he's pouring out on the earth, is past. For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth, not the church, not God's people, but the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also will disclose her blood and will no more cover her slain. And so God is talking about the great tribulation and hiding his people during the great tribulation. Probably has two fulfillments. One fulfillment to the Jews, where the light goes on following that abomination that causes desolation, and they go into the rock city of Petra. And it also can have a very, very strong reference to the rapture of the church, where he says, come, my people, and enter into your chambers. Come up into heaven and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a moment while he pours out his wrath upon the earth. And so a double fulfillment that is found there. And then God says, as it relates to his judgment, he's going to punish, again, the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth will disclose her blood. In other words, God is going to bring forth the guilt of the world in their killing of his people, and many of his people have been killed and will no more cover her slain. In other words, the innocent that have been killed in this world, God is going to reveal that and reveal the guilt of this world and the death of the innocent and the righteousness of his judgment that's poured out upon the earth. The other week I was coming driving to church, driving down Tully, and I saw a bumper sticker that really troubles me when I see it. And it's a bumper sticker that says, pro-family, pro-life, pro-choice. This kind of a deal. And always that thing where it's like pro-family, pro-choice, which just means pro-abortion. That's nice, because you got out of the womb to grow old enough to buy a truck and to drive it. But not everyone did. That is a mind that is so self-deceived, that is just beyond my imagination, even in the natural realm, that I can consider the killing of an innocent life to be pro-family. This has to be what God says it would be in the last days: good being called evil and evil being called good. But I'll tell you, when everything comes out into the open that God knows about this earth, there will not be a single complaint made against His judgment. In fact, it'll be praised. And all of heaven, we're told in the Revelation, explodes in praise, and our praise will be righteous and true are your judgments. When we see what has happened on this earth, see one day what He sees and He knows has happened, there'll only be praise for His judgment and the fact that He is going to bring man's rebellion against Him to an end. Now for you tonight, if you're here and you're not a Christian, I want you to know that your rebellion against God can come to an end tonight. You individually, so that you can become a part of His kingdom and you don't have to suffer the judgment that is due rebellion against Him. And your rebellion against Him is due judgment. My rebellion against God was due judgment. It was due not only the judgment of the great tribulation, it was due the judgment of an eternal lake of fire and separation from God. But there's no need to ever face judgment from God, because God has put His Son between you and judgment. And Jesus on that cross, oh, that cross, the mystery of the cross. What He bore in bearing our judgment on that cross so that we might never face that judgment. An awesome thing. But no person need ever face the righteous judgment of God, because Jesus has borne it for us. If we will just trust in Him for the forgiveness of our sins and give our life to Him and the salvation that He has provided, and then I can take all of this and I can commit it to God and enter into the praise that's due God for His nature and all of these other things, that I can say, that is not my portion because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and His love for me. There is an escape, and the escape is found in Him.